Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility present The Vermont Conversation with David Goodman. Exploring ideas with innovators, change makers, business leaders, politicians, and activists. This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is underwritten in part by The Alchemist Brewery of Waterbury and Stowe, committed to a healthy and clean environment, strong communities, and craft beer. AlchemistBeer.com. By Community Capital of Vermont, providing equal access to financing for Vermonters with excellent ideas and the courage and resourcefulness to start and grow small businesses. Green Mountain Power, partnering with customers to create a home, business, and community-based energy system that's clean, reliable, and cost-effective. Let's Grow Kids, a statewide campaign about the need for more high-quality, affordable child care in Vermont to better support our children, families, communities, and economy. And by UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, the heart and science of medicine, as well as nearly 700 BBSR business members who believe that sustainable business practices value people, planet, and profit. Learn more from www.vbsr.org.
Welcome to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. Poets Resist, Voices of Dissent. That's the name of an event that will be taking place on Tuesday, November 14th at the Unitarian Church in Montpelier, which will bring together a number of poets and artists from around the region, actually around the East Coast, to talk, to read their poetry, and talk about the connection between poetry and dissent. Today on the Vermont Conversation, we're going to spend the hour with two of those poets who will be appearing in that event. In the second part of our show, we'll be joined by Sarah Browning. She is the co-founder and executive director of Split This Rock, Poetry of Provocation and Witness. And in our first half hour, we'll be joined by Reuben Jackson, a name and voice who is familiar to many people as the host of Friday Night Jazz on Vermont Public Radio, which he's been doing since 2012. He's also an online mentor and workshop leader with the Vermont Young Writers Project. Prior to that, he was curator of the Duke Ellington Collection at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. for two decades. In addition, Reuben's music reviews have been published in the Washington Post, Jazz Times, on NPR's All Things Considered, and in other journals and magazines. Reuben Jackson, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Oh, David, thank you. It's great to be here. Good.
So reading your biography, Vermont is your adopted home. It sounds like much of your life you've spent in Washington, D.C. and beyond. What originally brought you to Vermont?
Goddard College. I attended Goddard from 1975 to 1978. And it was, you know, in my family, college was not and if it was a where. So we were going somewhere. And I read about Goddard at a magazine at a friend's house. I attended a party, and it sounded like a place that would I wouldn't drop out of. And I asked my friend if I could take the magazine home with the blurb in it, and he said, sure. I showed it to my father, and my father said, there's no way in Hades you're going to a school like this. I'm still shocked I didn't go to Notre Dame. But my mother, bless her, understood me, and she said to my father, if he goes to some big school, he'll drop out. And when my father left the room in a huff, she pulled me aside and said, I was in 11th grade. She says, you still got a year. I'll work on him. So that got me to Goddard and of course, got me to Vermont. And I started February 1975, graduated, oh my gosh, almost 40 years ago, December 1978, like a hairline and a lot of other things ago.
So this must have been culture shock. You go from D.C., very diverse city, to the whitest state in the nation.
Yes, yeah.
In Goddard College.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about that transition.
It's a Dr. Phil moment question. At the time, D.C. was maybe 75% black. And I knew, you know, there's like, as my father used to say, there's knowing and there's knowing. So I came up for a prospective weekend. I knew about Vermont. My family had also, we went to Montreal in 73 for a summer vacation and came back through. So I wasn't unaware of the, the demographic disparity here. But coming, knowing that and coming to a place, like getting off the train at 6 in the morning like I did at the Montpelier Junction to start school, and you get in the cab, and the cab driver is driving you to Plainfield, to Goddard, but he keeps looking in the rearview mirror, looking in the rearview mirror, and you think, I'm probably maybe the first or one of a few people of color he's seen. And that's when it, when you're out in the street and you're out in the community, it's when it really hits, and that you are constantly stared at. And like a lot of people in radio, I'm like not shy, but shy. And it was rough. You're 18 years old, and you're still at that point in life where you're trying to figure things out. And you go into a store to buy a pair of shoes, and people don't bother you necessarily, but they all crane their necks at once, and you're thinking, oh my gosh, did my parents' tuition check clear yet? I'm laughing, but it's, you know.
Did you feel like when you first arrived there that maybe you'd chosen to come to the wrong place?
No, Goddard was the right school for me, you know, among other things. I harp on the radio thing, but that's where I started doing radio. I mean, you could say I started in my parents' basement when I took the broomstick and pretended I was one of those rapid-tongued DJs, but it was the right place. I started writing or attempting to write poetry in earnest at Goddard. The challenge was, you know, the world beyond that kind of cloistered environment. And, you know, it's still a challenge here now. In the 70s, you just didn't see many people of color, even if you went to Chittenden County or Burlington. And I remember my parents came to pick me up in spring, and we went to the Wayside in Berlin, 302, and a black family came into, and my mother started like rapping on the glass. She was so happy. And I thought, in a way, like, I'm 18, so I'm a little bit embarrassed, but I'm that way now. And my heart just like opens when I see people of color. So it's, you know, it's 2017, but Vermont's an anomaly in that regard. And it's less so, but not by much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Vermont Conversation. My guest this half hour is Reuben Jackson, the host of Friday Night Jazz on Vermont Public Radio, and also a poet as well as a teacher. And if you want to join this conversation, you can call us at 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. So two big passions that are obvious in your life, music and poetry.
Sure.
Let's talk first about music. You have been a jazz aficionado, an expert, and now really kind of a griot, a storyteller who brings many people into the world of jazz to share your passion. Where did that start for you?
I would say it started in my parents' basement. I've said this before, but it remains true. I would say that my radio show is a high-tech version of my parents' basement. You know, I would, a couple of things, you know, we'd listen to records on Friday and Saturday night. It's, I'm telling my age here, you know, on the stereo. You all know what a stereo is. And my father and his friends were big jazz lovers. They'd go to the clubs in D.C. and, you know, they'd play records in the basement. I was a kid, I'd sit at the top of the steps and listen to the stories they would tell about seeing John Coltrane or Cannonball Adderley. And they knew I was up there. So the music and kind of the world around it tapped me on the shoulder very early. And, I mean, jazz, yes, but music in general really said to me, let's go, son. And it's, you want to learn more and more about it. And as I said at the outset, I wanted to be on the radio and imitate the programmers I heard. And so I would get in the basement sometimes by myself and play, I don't know, like Miles Davis's Kind of Blue, you know, and you try to do those cool late night voice things like it's Miles Davis with John Coltrane and Cannonball Adderley. You know, but I was hooked. And I think that the tie-in with poetry is language, you know, because you hear the way in which the programmers would describe the music, or, you know, growing up in church and hearing ministers and their thematic development and the way they would play with cadence. So it's, I think these things have run simultaneously since I was, as they say in my hometown of D, since I was a youngin'.
Is there, can you share your top three or top five favorite jazz tunes and the performers of them?
Oh my gosh, yeah, this is just an hour show, isn't it? What if I go with composers? It's a compromise.
As you wish.
I sound like a politician. Let me say this about that. Certainly, I'm thinking composition, Charles Mingus, Duke Ellington, Wayne Shorter, Mary Lou Williams, Cecil Taylor. I'll stop there. Yeah.
Charles Mingus, bass player.
Great bassist.
Shorter,
saxophone.
Player.
Yeah. Duke Ellington, of course, pianist, band leader, spokesperson. Mary Lou Williams, band leader, composer, educator, pianist. Cecil Taylor, pianist. I have a thing about piano. But just the breadth of those artists' contributions and like the music, they just hit me early on and they just continue to move me deeply.
When you seek consolation, when you've had a tumultuous day, week, whatever, what is the tune or the album that you put on?
Boy, that's really unpredictable because I also love opera. Like the other day, I had turned the news on when I came home, which is probably a mistake, like the old Culture Club song, Mistake Number 3.
Uh-huh.
And I was so depressed. I listened to, what was it? Nabucco. Because I love Verdi and all that. And so it varies. Now, if you're thinking jazz specifically, it might be kind of blue, Miles Davis, 1959, which I think is its own, like, sovereign nation, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And university, because every musician on that album went on to become
icons
of the jazz.
As I say on the air, I'm putting my hand over my musical heart when you say that.
Well, boy, we could just talk jazz for this entire time, but that would not do justice to your poetry. So, your life as a poet, when did that begin?
It began, and I'll be brief, it's a funny story. My 10th grade homeroom teacher, I went to what was then Western High School in Washington, D.C. It's now Duke Ellington School for the Arts. My homeroom teacher was editor of the school newspaper. One Friday, she came to me and said, out of the blue, I thought, I need a poem for next month's paper. Bring one in on Monday. So I said, well, who are your favorite writers? Because I thought what she meant was, go to the library, pick out, I don't know, Yeats or Nikki Giovanni and bring something in. And she says, no, I want you to write it. Well, I'd never mentioned anything about writing poetry at all. So I'm trying to figure out how to get out of this. And so I'll write like the worst poem I can think of, something really kind of mawkish, and I'll be out of it. There was a young lady in my typing class had one of those flawless afros, like those Angela Davis afros. So I wrote this poem called Ode to the Sister with the Most Perfect Afro. And I put every cliche in it. I thought, I'm free. Monday, I hand it in, and Miss Milbury says, Ruben, this is wonderful. Your staff poet will need a poem from you every month. And I thought, what? So I had this assignment, and I did it. I began to like it, and I'd go to the library and just take books of poetry out and read them, you know, and there was no respect to style or chronology. So I might come home with, like, Yeats and Amiri Baraka. And I would just try to imitate them. And before I knew it, you know, it wasn't castor oil anymore. It was like, okay, let's do this. And I would, you know, I'd take the thesaurus and pick out like six words and think, okay, use these today. And there were challenges like, can you use words like forsooth in 1972 in revolutionary times.
Well, let me have you read one of your poems.
Okay.
Why don't you read for Trayvon Martin?
Sure. This is a recent piece for Trayvon Martin, and I just want to briefly say this. This has as much to do with the relationship young African-American men have, and it's like the company of your boys. And the thing which haunts me and will continue to haunt me about Trayvon Martin is that he was walking home from the store. And when this happened, when he was murdered, I thought, how many times did you walk home from the store in any condition? You know, maybe I'd had too much to drink, I shouldn't have been doing it, what have you. And something simple like that could end up in such a catastrophic way. So the idea was to do what we did growing up, which was to walk your boys home. And it's the fantasy that came to my mind, if I could have walked him home. So that's kind of the premise. So for Trayvon Martin.
And maybe just to remind listeners, Trayvon Martin, 16-year-old African-American boy walking home from the store to his dad's
Sanford,
house.
Florida, right.
Murdered by a self-styled vigilante.
Right, George Zimmerman, yes.
Yes.
For Trayvon Martin, instead of sleeping, I walk with him from the store. No Skittles, thank you. We do not talk much. Sneakers crossing the courtyard, humid southern night. We shake hands and hug, ancient stoic tenderness. I nod to the moon. I'm so old school, I hang to the latch clicks like an unloaded gun.
What are you trying to convey in that poem?
Again, I think the struggle with maybe young men in general of kind of suppressed loyalty or bonds or tenderness toward each other. And I wanted to incorporate things that we did growing up to and for each other, walking each other home, waiting till you got in the house. I mean, it's the kind of thing you did on a date back in the day. And so there is that element of intimacy. And I would translate that to the love I felt and feel for this young man and all people trying to be or to become themselves in a world which can sometimes be quite hostile. You know, there are references to, well, like the ancient stoic tenderness. This is something I learned and working on unlearning, where you've got some feelings, but you're trying to be cool. And then, to, you know, contrast that with nodding to the moon. Like, I'm acknowledging this metaphor, this symbol of wonder and romance, but I'm nodding to it, like, you know. And they don't, well, Vermont, that's not a thing, but the nod, like you see another brother and go, like, how you doing? So trying to fuse those elements with this young man and getting him home. For me, it's just so simple. You're trying to go home. Mm-hmm. And that's, it just remains heartbreaking in ways that are almost inexpressible. Mm-hmm. The irony with this piece is it's already been in like three anthologies and a short film. It's the poem I wish to goodness I'd never written, you know. I'm glad it's in a book for like teaching poetry to middle school students. And I'm thankful, you know, you want to be read, but I wish I hadn't written it, which means, you know, this wouldn't have happened.
You also work with the Young Writers Project.
Mm-hmm.
What's that about? Why do you do it?
Well, I'll try to contextualize it here. I came to Vermont to be a teacher. I started working in after-school programs in D.C. in the year 2000 with an organization called D.C. Writers Corps. My mother was a teacher, a great teacher, and yet, like a lot of young people, you know, you see your parents' careers and you say to yourself, there's no way I'm doing what they did. I know she loved it very much, but I found my way into education and the classroom by way of poetry. So poetry for me is many things. One of those things is possibility. And what I came to enjoy and love deeply and still do, whether it's D.C. or Vermont or California, is, you know, what's going to come out of a young person's vision? What is their story? And the dignity, I think, expressing your questions, your unknowns as, well, someone of any age. I mean, there's no, to use a cliche, you can't put a dollar sign on that. And when you see the confidence which can come out of expression or working or reworking an idea, or even as a younger person, maybe starting a piece and not necessarily having, quote, an answer to something, it's still, it's giving honor to your life. And I am like my mother, who would laugh to hear this in a nice way, I think. You know, I really believe in young people, and I get a lot from them. When things are, to me, education is like tennis. It's back and forth. It's not the supposedly sagacious individual dispensing knowledge. It's, what do you give me? We're trading fours, like musicians. And it, you know, it reminds me that the possibilities within language are infinite, and that, you know, I've often had to think or rethink ideas as a result of these wonderful workshops. And as my aunt in Georgia would say, baby, you know, there's no substitute for that.
You're listening to the Vermont Conversation. We're talking with Reuben Jackson. He is the host of the jazz show on Vermont Public Radio every Friday, Friday Night Jazz, and also a poet who will... but before we go any further, Reuben, you dropped some big news on Facebook this week announcing that you will be leaving Friday Night Jazz in April.
At the end of April, right, yes.
Which will be about 6 years total, which I was surprised about. Your voice and musical styles, I feel like, have been with me for a lifetime, even though it's actually a relatively short time.
Thank
Why
you.
Are you leaving VPR?
I don't mean to be cryptic with this answer, but essentially it's time. I think that, you know, I've learned a lot in this 5 year, it would have been 6 years in August, stint at VPR. One is, it's given me a chance to rekindle a deep love for radio, you know, that I've had. Again, I started at Goddard when I was 18. And, of course, the music will always be with me. I'm just, you know, when a plane lands and they say, when you're reaching for your overhead bag, be careful because the contents may have shifted during the flight. You know, I would say the last 5 years or so, the contents of my life have shifted dramatically. You know, some, I'm sure, triggered by big events like my brother's death and some other things. And I just want to breathe and see, like, what is next. I can't, you know, I'm sorry I'm not more specific than that, but it really just comes down to it's time, and you hear what my mother would say, like, listen to the inner Reuben. The inner Reuben kind of thought about this, and it's not an easy decision because, I mean, that great music library, and this, you build these relationships with people by way of programs, as you know, but it's, what's that Kenny Rogers song? Knowing to hold 'em, knowing to fold 'em. So I'm getting a little, you know, emotional here, but it's time to fold them for now.
Any idea what you will do with your Friday evenings?
Oh,
will
no.
Will you be elsewhere on the dial? Would you?
I have no idea. I'll quote Rilke from Letters to a Young Poet when he says you should love the questions like unlocked doors or like locked doors. I'm sitting with the questions. I sound like a third-rate Buddhist here, but I am. And this big unknown is in front of me, and it's bittersweet, but I'm basically okay with it. So I don't know. I could be bowling Friday night. Who knows? Mahjong, who can say?
Well, let me have you read another one of your poems called April 1975 to close out our half hour with you.
Sure. This was inspired by something which happened at a general store in East Montpelier. This was during my first semester at Goddard, and it addresses one of your earlier questions about dealing with the profound change of environment or in environment. So, April 1975. Should my black Flatlander eyes lock on the other brother in the general store? The first I've seen in since what seems like I can't count that high. Do I pretend I don't see other people pretending not to see us? Two brothers buying Triscuits and peanut butter, respectively, in northern New England is revolution on a Sunday afternoon.
That's Reuben Jackson. He is one of a number of poets who will be part of Poets Resist Voices of Dissent on Tuesday, November 14th, speaking at the Unitarian Church of Montpelier. Well, Reuben Jackson, I want to thank you for joining us on the Vermont Conversation.
Oh, thank you. It's been an immense pleasure.
We'll be back just after the news and speak with another poet, Sarah Browning, who will join us for the next half hour. I'm David Goodman. We'll be right back.